Okay, round page 680, Pasuk Chavav, the middle of the page. Chapter 22, Pasuk Chavav, 26. Okay, these few psukim we learned, let's just go quickly. Hashem said to Meshach like this, Shere chesev eis ki yivaled, if you'll have a bull, a sheep, or a goat is born, and you want to bring it as a sacrifice, so the Torah says, Vayishivas yamim tachasimei, it has to be 7 days under the mother. From the 8th day, Yerotza will be appeased. Basically, the Torah says, even though an ox is called an ox the day it's born, you need to wait 7 days until you're able to bring it as a sacrifice. Last time we explained just briefly, because it needs to go through a Shabbos, just like a baby, the bris is 8th day, because it needs to live through the whole cycle of the week in a Shabbos. So the same thing it says, an animal needs to wait 7 days until it's able to be fit for a sacrifice. Then there's another din, v'sharei sa'esev as b'nei, le'iseshchato b'yemechot. This is a din not only by sacrifices, by everything. There's a din that if you have an ox or a goat or a sheep, you cannot shecht it and its child on the same day. This b'chal applies not only in korbanos, but anything. In other words, therefore, people would have to tell not butchers, the people that sold the cattle, would have to tell somebody if the mother was sold that day, they would have to tell them if the next guy wants to buy the calf, they would have to say you better check out to make sure the mother animal is not being slaughtered that day. Or if this kid, the calf was taken to slaughter, you can't slaughter the mother the same day. Okay? That applies not only for sacrifices, but anything.
Is this only for ox, sheep, and goat, or all
animals? All kosher animals. Okay?
Doesn't apply to the birds?
What?
To the birds, too?
No. Just, the Torah says clearly, shar eseh, cattle and sheep. Okay, this is where we're up to now. Pasuk Chavtes. V'chi sizbuchu zevach teilo l'Hashem. When you slaughter a Thanksgiving carbon to Hashem, l'tzeinchem tizbachu, you need to slaughter it to gain acceptance. Meaning, simply it means, the Gemara says, that you need to make sure that you're doing it the right way, that it's acceptable by Hashem. You can't have the foreign thoughts, you know, eating it after the time and doing the Aveda the wrong way. And then the Torah says, b'yemahu yeyachol, you can eat the sacrifice that day, l'yseisiru mimenu ad beker, you're not allowed to leave it over until the morning. Ani Hashem, I am Hashem. Now, there is, as we say some of us say in davening, women usually don't say this too much, but every korban has the allotted time that you're allowed to eat it. Now, for instance, Toda, which he's speaking about over here, V'chisiz b'chusevach Toda, you could eat it, you can eat it the day you shecht it until midnight. Okay? You're not allowed to leave it over until the morning. If you leave over meat until the morning, it's called noisar. You have to burn it, and you're not allowed to eat that meat. And you did a sin by leaving it over. So the Torah says, if you did it,
yeah.
No.
What if you can't eat it? It's too much meat.
You have to give it out and make sure, like it says, the Torah was eaten for any Jew. You didn't have to be a kohen. Any Jew could eat it. You have to make sure that you had enough people to eat it that day and the night, and le'sisiru mimenu abeker, and not allowed to leave it over until the morning. Now, this is even if you shechted it with the right intent, that you're going to eat it in the right place in the right time. You still can't leave it over until the morning. Certain korbanos were eaten for 2 days and a night. The Shnei Yom and V'layla Echad. Okay? 2 days and one night. The Korban Torah, as the Torah speaks about, was allowed to be eaten that day, that night. The Chachamim said, you have to, like we say in Davening, Ad Chatzais, until midnight, because we don't want you to fall asleep, and then you're going to end up leaving over the meat until the morning. So the Chachamim said, you need to do it up to midnight. You cannot do it later. Okay. Now it starts a new thing. Ushmartem mitzvaysai, you need to guard my mitzvahs. Vasisem esam, and you need to do them. Ani Hashem, I am Hashem. Now, what does it mean, Ushmartam Vasisam? I mean, it seems, obviously, we do mitzvahs. I mean, the Torah wants us to do mitzvahs. So the learns, Rashi explains what it means is, you have an obligation to learn all the things you need to know about the mitzvahs. Because the Torah says, keep the mitzvahs properly. What is properly? How are you going to know what proper is if you don't go learn? So the Torah basically, like Rashi is saying, Ushmartam zu ha-mishnah, vasisim is the action. So there's two mitzvahs over here. You have to learn about the mitzvahs, otherwise how are you going to know what to do? And you have to keep them. So it's not a double expression. What?
And apply them.
Huh? And apply them. Yeah, of course. That's the way Rashi learns. Ramban learns that this refers to disqualifications, the blemishes, you know, that you can't shech the carbon too early, you know, everybody. But this, by the way, is connected to every Jew. Shmartim mitzvah is not only the Kohanim. Every Jew needs to learn the mitzvahs, keep them, understand them, study them, and so on. Another thing is, by the way, Shmartim mitzvah in different places, the Gemara says, it means you need to make a fence around the Torah. How do you guard something? You guard something by making a fence around the Torah. Right? Like it says, to make a fence around the Torah. So the Torah says, the Shmartem also means to actually make a fence around the Torah to protect it. Not say, okay, I'm going to come to the edge of the cliff and I won't fall off. Because God forbid, transgressing a sin is like falling off, spiritually falling off a cliff. So you have to make a protection, like the Chachamim make. Okay, next is a very, very important pasuk, which basically talks about desecration of God's name and making a Kiddush Hashem. So the Torah says like this, you're not allowed to desecrate the name of God. V'nigdashti, I should be sanctified b'seich b'nei Yisrael, amongst the Jewish people. Ani Hashem mikadishchem, I am God who sanctifies you. Now the Gemara learns out like this. This pasuk is a very broad term, meaning what's called in modern day language, Chilul Hashem. You cannot do anything that desecrates the name of God. Anything that will give the impression that somebody will say, ah, look at these Jews, look at the, you know, look what they're doing this wrong, that wrong, that. That's all biblically forbidden. And as we'll soon learn, Chilul Hashem is one of the worst aveiros. When the Gemara speaks about tshuva, the Gemara says, if you transgress a positive mitzvah, you do tshuva, you're forgiven. You transgress a negative commandment, you have to do tshuva, wait for Yom Kippur. If you do kares, mises, bezdin, you know, worse sins, capital punishment sins, so then you need tshuva and Yom Kippur and punishment. And then the Gemara says in Yuma, there's a fourth category of sin, chilul Hashem. And the Gemara says then, it's not enough tshuva, it's not enough Yom Kippur, it's not enough punishment, death is the only forgiveness for Chilul Hashem. That's the question.
Someone who's doing Chilul Hashem by neglecting the commandments, or someone doing Chilul Hashem on an ignorant level? Like someone who knows, or someone who doesn't know? You could do Chilul Hashem, let's say the Hellenists, the Greek Jews, they were doing Chilul Hashem with knowledge.
Well, obviously that's... That's much worse, though.
So it's... There are differences of punishment for different levels for Chilul Hashem?
Of course there's Chilul Hashem. For instance, the Gemara says, Rav Yehuda, the Gemara said, and what's unique about Chilul Hashem, it's not what you do, it's the way it's perceived. Mm-hmm. You might be doing something 100% correct. If somebody will look at you and be able to mistake that what you're doing is something wrong, it's a Chilul Hashem even though you didn't do anything wrong. And an example of this, the Gemara says, Rav Yehuda, and the Gemara says, he was the Rav of the city, in Bavel, where he lived. He said, if I take meat on credit from the butcher, when nobody else gets credit, meaning, obviously me, he trusts because I'm the Rav, so he's going to trust me. But if nobody else takes credit, gets credit, and I'm going to walk into the store and take meat without paying for it, so even though the storekeeper has no problem with it, right, I'm taking on credit, but other people don't know that, And therefore, the Yehuda said, that would be Chilul Hashem. Even though he didn't do anything wrong. People will perceive it to do a wrong thing. And therefore it says extremely, people have to be extremely careful, you know, the way they act in public. If they're going to do things that will cause people to say, ah, oh, look at that Jew, or things like that. And it could be a broad, you know, Chilul Hashem could be cutting somebody off in a car. You know, when you're driving, like all the Jews do, cut somebody else off, or do anything in business with people that you could be misleading, that they think you're doing something wrong. That's Chilul Hashem. And the Torah said, V'loy sechalu lo Hashem kachi. Okay, and there's nothing greater than that concept of desecration of Hashem's name. Then the Torah says a second thing. V'negdashti b'seich b'nei Yisrael. Now, what does this mean? That's the mitzvah of what's called Kiddush Hashem. Sanctification of God's name. There's three cardinal sins that we know you have to give up your life for and not transgress. Idolatry, adultery, and murder. Okay, Gilei Arayos, Shfichas Damim, and Aveda Zara. Two of them are learned out from a pasuk. One is likened to another one of the two. And therefore the bottom line is, if somebody comes over to a person with a gun to the head and says, either bow down to an idol or commit adultery or kill somebody or else I'll kill you, you have to let yourself be killed and you're not allowed to do it. Okay, that's the halacha. It's interesting, murder, the Gemara says, is a logic. What's the logic of murder? The Gemara has it's a secular expression already. Machozes the damach sumak tvei. Literally means, who said your blood is redder? In other words, the Torah is saying, a very interesting way the Gemara in Psachim learns this out. The Gemara says, your blood is as just as red as anybody else's blood. Meaning, everybody's equal. Life-wise, everybody's equal. Okay? So who says, your blood is better than this guy's blood? If they say, kill them, or else I'll kill you, so why should you do an act of murder if your life and his life are equally life? It's not any better. So therefore, you have to be passive and get killed rather than go act and kill somebody else. Or there's another din in the Gemara, but on Shulchan Aruch, if a goyim come to a city and say, we want to, you know, they're out to get somebody, okay, and the city is protecting the person. And the person comes to the city and says, give us this guy out to us, or else we'll kill the whole city. The law is you're not allowed to give him out. Because then you're actively doing a murder, you'll have to let, halachically, the whole city get killed, but you're not allowed to bring them out to get killed. Okay? So there's murder, you have to give up your life. Adultery, the Gemara learns it out for murder. How? Because it speaks about, in Parshas, later on in Chumash, in Kiseitze, I think it is, the Torah speaks, if God forbid somebody rapes a girl in the field. So the Torah says like this, Ki kasha yokum ish al reyayahu vahorgay nefesh, the Torah likens rape, meaning adultery, to murder. The Gemara says, because the Torah says, just like you're killing somebody, that's the same thing what rape is. So it's like a form of adultery. So the Gemara says, if for murder you have to give up your life, for adultery also, in idolatry they learn out from a pasuk. So the bottom line is that a person has to give up his life for those sins. Interestingly, what happens if a person doesn't? Somebody comes to you with a gun and says, bow down to an idol, else I'll kill you. And you can't withstand the temptation, and you bow down to an idol. So the Rambam says, you're not punished, because you're still forced. Even though halachically, you had to give up your life, nevertheless, you're not punished because you were forced to do it.
So, you didn't do it intentionally.
No, you were forced.
Yeah.
You did it, but they forced you to do it.
Not from your own will.
Right, not from your own will. Now, even with adultery, by the way, there's a difference between a man and a woman. A woman, God forbid, let's say a married woman, God forbid, who's being raped. Right? So it's adultery because she's married. She doesn't have to give up her life. She doesn't have to say to the guy, kill me. Or, you know, rather than committing it. Well, if a guy says to a girl, I'll rape you, either let me rape you or I'll kill you, she doesn't have to say, kill me. Why? But the Gemara uses the expression, like we find by Esther, the Gemara uses this expression in the Megillus Esther, karka elam. Karka elam means she's, in practical language it means, she's not taking an active role, like a man takes an active role in adultery, the woman is taking a passive role, unless she wants to, then she's taking an active role. But God forbid if a woman is raped, or forced, so then it's a passive role, and therefore she doesn't have to give up her life. A man would have to give up his life because he's an active part of the adultery. That's how the Gemara explains. Oh, Esther lived with Achashverosh. She was married to Mordechai. How does she live with Achashverosh? Why isn't it adultery? And the whole great discussion in the commentaries about what Esther did with Achashverosh, what she did, what she didn't, or whatever. So these three things, you have to give up your life. What happens again? The Rama says, if you were forced and you sinned, even though you didn't do good, you didn't do what's right, you don't get killed because, bottom line, you were forced. But now there's another din. What happens, though, if in public, the goyim want you to desecrate the sin? In public. That's what it says, v'nikdashti b'seich b'nei Yisrael, when there's a minyan. There's a minyan of Jews, okay, and the goyim are out to, so to speak, defile and impurify Yiddishkeit. And they come over to a Jew in public and say to him, either eat pig or else I'll kill you. He has to give up his life. Because over there is already public. In private, if they say, you know, eat treif or else I'll kill you, halacha says eat the treif. Right? Halacha says you can eat the treif. But what happens if it's in public? He says, in the presence of 10 Jews, however, Hashem's name would be desecrated if the deed were done, even if the non-Jew's motive was personal pleasure, not to cause him violence, he has to choose death. And then there's another interesting argument, by the way, in Halacha, which is very interesting. What happens... This is not mentioned here at all, but in Halach it says like this. What happens in private? Now we know you're not allowed to commit suicide. Right? You're not allowed to kill yourself. What happens in private? Somebody comes over to a Jew with a gun to the head and says, eat treif or else I'll kill you. And the Jew doesn't want to eat. What does Halach say? Halach says, eat the treif. But you don't give up your life, but when it comes to kashrus. But the guy says, you know what? Kill me. It's in private, not even in public. Somebody comes to his head with a gun and says, eat this pig or else I'm going to kill you. And the guy says, kill me. Is that considered suicide or not? This is a very interesting machlekes in the Rishonim, in the earlier codifiers. Is a Jew allowed to do that or not? Many opinions say he's not allowed to do it. Torah says, eat the pig and don't get killed. What are you giving up your life for? Other opinions say you're allowed to. And the accepted halacha is that you are allowed to. You are allowed to give up your life and it's not considered suicide even though the Torah says you really have to eat the pig and not get killed.
So how in the time of the Spanish Inquisition they converted,
The Muranos.
Instead of doing
the Muranos, is an extremely complicated halachic issue. Mm-hmm. Bottom line, the Muranos were not allowed to do what they did. Mm-hmm. They were not allowed to do what they did. Again, they were forced, mm-hmm. So they can't be punished for what they did. But halachically, they did not do what they were supposed to do. And I want you to know for a long, long time, till today, people will not, there are many people that will not marry into a Murano family because of that.
What did they do? Pretended that they converted?
Yeah. they used to go to church. That in the cellars, and the, you know, they had these private, they stayed Jewish deep in the house. But outwardly, they went to church and they acted like the goyim, you know. The Maranos are, if you want to learn halacha, the Maranos are not allowed to do what they did.
The Rambam said
yes. The Maranos were the people, the Spanish Jews in the time of the Inquisition. 1492. When King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, they threw the Jews out of Spain.
Right.
So those times, the Jews that were wealthy, many of them stayed. They officially became goyim. In hiding, they kept all the mitzvahs. And many of them were caught, and because they suspected them, they were tortured in public. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is the Maranos openly accepting Christianity and secretly not doing it, they were not allowed to do it.
But I don't know, somewhere I read that the Rambam said they were allowed to do it.
The Rambam?
Yes.
The Rambam was much before the Inquisition.
No, I know. After when they discussed.
No, the only thing I'm telling you, what the Rambam says, is that even those things, if you were forced, you're not punished. But they still didn't do what they want. They still didn't do what they were supposed to do. But
what about the people in Masada? The Romans wanted to kill them, and they killed themselves.
We learned that in Parshas Noach about how many years ago? There's a whole discussion about the Masada people, if they were allowed to do what they did. The discussion goes even earlier. When Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, yeah? The predecessor of David HaMelech, when he was being chased by the Plishtim, by the Philistines, and they finally caught up to him, it says in the Navi that Shaul HaMelech said to his servant, "Kill me, I don't want to die in their hands, I want to die by a Jew. Kill me." And the young kid, obviously, he told Shaul HaMelech, "I'm not doing it. I refuse to do it." So it says that Shaul HaMelech took a sword, put it in the ground with the sharp side up, and he fell on top of his sword and killed himself. That's what it says in Tanakh. So the whole controversy in Halacha, was he allowed to do it? Was he not allowed to do it? The Masada issue. And there's a lot in the Sefer Teresh Shleima, which is brings a lot of commentaries on Chumash, has a whole section on this whole concept in Parshas Noach, where it says, "Aches dimchem nafshe sechem edrish," where the Torah says, you know, to commit suicide. So over there, the whole shaila is, in Halacha, are you allowed to do it or not? And he brings out many stories that took place historically, that there were a situation where goyim were going to come and kill out a whole city, and they knew they were coming, and the Jews asked the Shaila if they're allowed to get killed, if they can kill themselves instead, rather than die in the hands of the Goyim. And there's a certain Rav said, yes, kill yourself. And then they found out that they ended up not coming to the city to kill them. And they were saved. Those Jews that didn't kill themselves were saved. And they said, therefore, how do you know what's going to be? How can you kill yourself before the Goyim? Maybe something will happen and the Goyim won't kill you. Like, so how are you killing yourself earlier? Maybe the guy won't kill you. Who knows what will happen? Right. And they bring down many stories. So the Masada story, by the way, I know Masada in Israeli culture, even Yiddish culture, were like heroes, right? But many poskim and halacha question if they're allowed to do what they did. It's not such an easy thing.
Wait, so Shlomo HaMelech?
Shaul HaMelech.
Oh, Shaul.
Shaul, not Shlomo.
He killed himself.
Shaul killed himself. That's what it says in the book called Tanakh. But
the normal gesture of saying hello in certain groups is by bowing down to each other. Is a Jew allowed to bow down to, say, a Japanese person? They're like saying goodbye, and you do that. You're not praising them, you're not.
If it's a form of greeting, not a form of religion, you're allowed to. But if there be an idol, I mean, you know the story with Chan and the seven kids. One of the things the king said to the kid, "I'll put my ring on the floor, just bend down and pick it up." And the kid said no, and he got killed. You know, if it's a bowing in any way of a religious nature, you wouldn't be allowed to do it. If it's just, you know, sometimes people see each other, they go like this, you know. They nod, but they bend down. It's not bowing. Nobody said bow to him. So it depends if it's a greeting or a bowing. Okay, that's... Now, kid, what?
I had this question. I never had the guts to ask it.
Which one?
This question.
Bowing? What? How much guts do you need to ask that question? It's a legitimate question. It's a good question. Okay, now, Kiddush Hashem could also be, in a lot of ways, not only giving up your life. Kiddush Hashem, for instance, if a person, let's say, doesn't sin, not because of money, pressure, and honor, but because Hashem said so, that's a Kiddush Hashem. If you go out of your way to act nicely to a non-Jew, because of Kiddush Hashem, like the Gemara tells a story, that I think it was Rabbi Yechanan, that he bought a cow from a guy and there was a diamond around the neck of the animal. So technically he would be allowed to keep it, but instead he went and gave it back. And the guy was shocked and he said, wow, look how wonderful the Jewish people are. That is all including in Kiddush Hashem. In other words, Kiddush Hashem does not only mean you have to give up your life for Yiddishkeit, it means just doing things that make God's name blessed, that people bless God's name, or like people, that if you do something that people will say, fortunate our parents and teachers who raised such a person, that's called a Kiddush Hashem. So it's not only a question of life and death. You could desecrate Hashem's name in many very different ways, and you could sanctify the name of Hashem in many different ways. Okay, then it's, and not to desecrate, okay. Now, Rabbeinu B'chayir brings on an interesting thing, that if one transgressed, what's the tshuva? Now we don't have Beis Din killing you and all that, okay? So, Rabbeinu B'chayir, or Bachi, whichever way you say, says, what do you do if somebody made a Chilul Hashem? He desecrated God's name. In fact, you know, the Gemara says, very interesting statement, the Gemara says, if a person has such a strong urge to sin, they can't hold themselves back. The Gemara uses the following expression. Go to a place where nobody knows you. Do what the Gemara says. Go to a place nobody knows you. Shave off your beard. Take off your kippah. Look like a guy. And then go sin. Because at least you won't desecrate the name of Hashem. Yeah. Huh?
I knew that also.
No, as I'm saying, that's what... So he says like this. What happens if somebody desecrated Hashem's name? So he says, what's the tshuva? What should be done? He says, you do things to make a Kiddush Hashem. You know, to sanctify the name of God. Or, he says, do things similar to the sin. In other words, you desecrated Hashem's name, sanctify God's name. If somebody sinned by slandering others, so your mouth sinned, use the mouth to study Torah. If he used his eyes to look at forbidden things, you should cry. If someone committed bunches of sin, you should do bunches of mitzvahs. In other words, to counteract the sin, mida keneged mida, so to speak, whatever the person sinned, is to make it up by sanctifying the name of Hashem. Okay. Now, Rashi also quotes over here that what does it mean, v'leisa chalalu? Okay? He says like this. When you give up your life, Rashi says, don't think a miracle is going to happen. Like it says, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, these three great tzaddikim were thrown into the fire by Nebuchadnezzar, by the king of Babel, the Babylonian king. He threw them into a fire. And Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah said to him, that you know what? God can make a miracle that we won't get burnt either. And that's what happened. He threw them into the fire, and they came out alive. Okay, but the Gemara says they didn't do it knowing, thinking that a miracle will happen. They just told it to Nebuchadnezzar. But it says here, they were prepared to let themselves be burnt rather than to transgress. But there's another interesting concept, by the way. Any Jew, and this is a remarkable thing also, any Jew who is killed because he's a Jew is automatically holy. He's called a martyr, straight Gan Eden. Straight. That means if you can have in the, I'm not talking about the Mumbai story, you know, but if you have a, in a Jewish neighborhood, you know, the African Americans, just to speak politely, the African Americans would shoot somebody, kill them just because they're Jewish. Or an anti-Semite will kill a Jew, or a communist, or whatever it may be, you know, Islam, whatever, they'll kill a Jew just because he's a Jew. Whoever dies because they're a Jew automatically goes straight to Gan Eden. They're called a Kaddish. That's why the 6 million are called the 6 million Kaddishim. Mm-hmm. The holy people, because they were killed for one reason only, just because they're a Jew. So you automatically get this thing, the degree of being a holy person, and they go straight to Gan Eden.
And those who escaped also,
huh?
Those who escaped also are Kedoshim, right?
Yeah, but not the same Kedoshim as mm-hmm. a person who was actually killed, Al Kiddush Hashem. Okay, then it says, Ani Hashem Mekadishchem, meaning, I am Hashem who sanctifies you. If you, the Sephardim says, if you dedicate your life to me, then I will personally deal with you, rather than through any intermediaries, you'll have a straight connection to Hashem. Hameiti eschem eretz Mitzrayim, who took you out from Egypt, liyas lochem lelikim, to be your God, ani Hashem ayam Hashem. Rashi says, what does this mean? I took you out of Egypt, Hashem says, on the condition that you sanctify my name. So it's like a deal. I took you out on the condition. So therefore, I have a right to demand it, because that's the condition I took you out of here. If not, you could have stayed there. So this is the condition. That's what the Torah is saying over here. The Ramban adds to it, by saving you from slavery, you became my slaves, and therefore I have a right to demand whatever I want. Okay. This is the end of... And the truth is, the whole concept of Chil Hashem, Kiddush Hashem, is discussed a lot in Halacha and in Svarim. You know, what constitutes sanctifying the name, desecration of Hashem's name, and all the details involved. Okay, by the way, there's another interesting Gemara, what's called Arkas de Mesana. Arkas de Mesana means literally a red shoelace. In the olden times, the goyim had a certain shoelace color. A shoelace, not mamish the color of a shoelace, that was their thing. And the Jews didn't wear it. If a guy came over to a Jew and said, I want you to wear a red shoelace because I want you to dress like a guy. If not, I'll kill you. If the purpose is to undo the religious aspect of the Jew, he has to give up his life. He has to give up his life, and not even if it's a shoelace. Like, not even an Averis, just a shoelace. Sometimes a Jew would have to give up their life if their intent is to be Ma'avir al-Adas, to get the person away from Yiddishkeit. That's the extent of Kiddush Hashem. So it's interesting, because today we don't have that test. But people want to act like Goyim anyway. You know? It's funny. You know? Years ago, the Goyim tried to force the Jews to act like Goyim, and the Jews gave up their life not to act like a Goy. And here, Jews have the freedom to act like a Jew, and instead, the Jews want to act like a guy. So it's strange.
Is that considered a
temple?
Is that considered a Hashem?
It is. It is. If a Jew wants to act and acts like a guy, yeah, it's a Chil Hashem. We're supposed to be different. Okay, the next Yitzukim. By the way, this is a kriya that we read on every Yom Tov, starting from Shor HaChesed Ve'Eiz. But now the Torah says like this, V'edav Hashem HaMeisha Leimer. Hashem spoke to Meisha, Daber al B'nei Yisrael V'amarta Aleihem, speak to the Yidden and tell them. Now this din applies not only to Kayanim, obviously it says B'nei Yisrael, everybody. Me'adei Hashem, the Yom Tovim of Hashem, the Chagim of Hashem, Asher Tikru Eisam Mikroi Kedesh, that you are to designate them as holy festivals. These are the chagim. Okay? In middle, the Torah goes in the next pasuk about keeping Shabbos, which we'll soon see why the Torah starts off at Yom Tov, goes to Shabbos, and then goes right back to Yom Tov. You just see the pasuk, Sheish Yom Tov Yasa Melacha, 6 days work, 7 days don't, it's Shabbos. And then again the Torah says, Eilem Me'adei Hashem, these are the Chagim of Hashem. Now, this pasuk is a very interesting pasuk, because this pasuk shows the power of a Jew, of the Jews. Okay? There's a difference between, I'm giving this as an introduction to the next few psukim as follows. There is Yom Tov, and there is Shabbos. Shabbos is not up to the courts. Shabbos is, as we say, Mikatsha v'kaima. Shabbos is holy by itself. The courts don't proclaim Shabbos, Shabbos. Shabbos is Shabbos. Yom Tov is dependent up to the courts. What do you mean it's dependent unto the courts? The Torah says Pesach is the 15th of Nisan. Who decides when Rosh Chodesh is to make the 15th of Nisan when the 15th of Nisan is? Beis Din proclaimed. Now we have a calendar, which is also set up by Beis Din. Hillel's grandson, whose name was Hillel, he was the one that set up the calendar the way we have it today, the 19-year cycle and the whole Jewish calendar that you go until the end of time. But even after he established the calendar, Beis Din, you know, like we learned before, the witnesses came, they saw the moon, Beis Din checked it out, testified, accepted the witnesses, Beis Din said, okay, today's Rosh Chodesh. Right? What happens, Beis Din says, no, today's not Rosh Chodesh, tomorrow's Rosh Chodesh. So that's when Rosh Chodesh is. Based on that, that's when Pesach is. That's when Yom Kippur is. That's when Rosh Hashanah is. So who makes the Chagim? Beis Din. And therefore the Torah says like this. If you look in the Pasuk, V'amart aleim, me'adei Hashem, asher tikru eisam mikroi kedesh. Literally it means that you are to designate them. Okay? Now, whoever knows Hebrew knows eisam is spelled Aleph Vav Saf Mem. Normally, Osam is with a Vav. Here, Osam is without a Vav. Without the Vav, you could read it Atem. Atem means you. And the Gemara learns, what is this pasuk teaching us? Asher tikru Atem Mikrei Kodesh. You, Jews, you're the ones that make it. And the Gemara says, Atem, Afilu Sheigigin, Afilu mezidin, afilu metoin. Even if Beis Din made a mistake on the date, it doesn't matter. Once Beis Din proclaims it, that's the day of Rosh Chodesh. And Memele, that's when Pesach is. Shavuot, Sukkot, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, whatever the Yom Tov is. Even if Beis Din intentionally said no, for whatever reason, Beis Din said, we are making it now. Rosh Chodesh, that's when Rosh Chodesh becomes. And therefore we know there's the famous Medrash and the famous Gemara, that the Malachim, you know, Rosh Hashanah comes, you have the good Malachim, the bad Malachim, the Satan, the, you know, the prosecuting angels, the defending angels, they come to Hashem, and they say, God, you know, when's Rosh Hashanah? We need to get ready. Hashem says, I don't know, whenever the Beis Din makes Aleph Tishrei, that's when Rosh Hashanah, Hashem says, not up to me. I don't know when Rosh Hashanah is. It's up to the Beis Din, not up to me. When they mean it, Beis Din will invite me. This is Rosh Hashanah, I'll come to judge the world. And this explains a very interesting, we learned this in the Agadah Shel Pesach, but this is a very interesting difference. You know, we daven, we say Kiddush, we do things, and we don't stop to think for a minute what we're saying. When you daven Shemoneh Esrei and Shabbos, or when you make Kiddush and Shabbos, what do we say at the end of the bracha? Baruch Ato Hashem, Mikadesh HaShabbos. Blessed are you Hashem, who sanctifies the Shabbos. What do we say on Yom Tov? We don't say Baruch Ato Hashem, Mikadesh HaZimanim. we see Mikadish Yisrael v'hazmanim. He sanctifies the Jews. Zmanim is Yom Tov. Even when Yom Tov falls on a Shabbos, you know what do we say? Mikadish HaShabbos v'Yisrael v'hazmanim. Why? Why do we say differently Shabbos and Yom Tov? There's a reason. Shabbos is not up to Yisrael. Shabbos is not up to Beis Din. Shabbos is up to Hashem. So Baruch Ato Hashem Mikadish HaShabbos. Hashem makes the Shabbos. Hashem does not make the Yom Tov holy. Beis Din makes the Yom Tov holy. So Mekadish Yisrael, Hashem sanctifies the Jews, Beis Din, which represents the Jews, the Hazmanim and the Yom Tov. And this is all learned from this pasuk, by the way. The Gemara learns it all from this pasuk. Ela merde Hashem ashetikru atem. Even though you read it Eisam, but it's written atem, that is totally up to Beis Din to figure out when Rosh Chodesh is, and therefore the Yom Tov are based on that.
It's not written atem. Why it's not atem?
Because in Chumash you have Kri and Ksiv. You have the way it's written, the way it's read. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of words like that. Mm-hmm. The Taka, the Gemara, usually learns out various different halachas. Why is we read it one way, but it's written a different way?
Mm-hmm. No, but it is a remez. That's what you mean. It's a form of remez.
That's the way the Torah teaches us. Mm-hmm. How does? Where do we see in the Torah that the Torah gives Beis Din the jurisdiction to what? To proclaim Yom Tov from this pasuk? Asher tikru atem. It should have said with a vav, aysam. It says atem. It's up to Beis Din completely to be able to know when Yom Tov is. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the Gemara tells a famous story. It's one of the reasons why Rambam Gamliel was ousted as the leader of the Jewish people. Rambam Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua had a fight when Rosh Chodesh should be. So it ended up to be a machlekes about Rosh Chodesh Tishrei. You're both in the Beis Din. So Rambam Gamliel was the head of the Beis Din, so it's up to him. So he decreed, and there's no ego here, you're talking about holy, 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 the holiest. But he had to show the authority of the head of the Beis Din. So he decreed that Rabbi Yeshua has to come to him on the day that Rabbi Yeshua thought is Yom Kippur, with his walking stick and his money pouch, just to show that Yom Kippur is not the day he made, but it's the day he made. And Rabbi Yeshua did it. Chacham were upset with Rambam Gamliel because of it, whatever. It was one of the three things that he did that they ousted him eventually for a while. But the whole concept of Yom Tov is totally up to Beis Din. And that's why this shows, so to speak, the power of the Jew. That on a Yom Tov there's more Kedusha in the world. Who calls the shots if there's more Kedusha in the world? It's a holy day. Makes more Kedusha in the world, this is the power of the Jew. And that's the greatness of the Jew. So he says like this, Shetikru Eisam Mikroi Kedush. Okay. These are the holy days. And why is it called Mikroi Kedush? In the English, it's translated as designated days. Literally, Mikroi Kedush means you call it Kedush. So the Mefarshim explain, the Ramban explains, these are the days when the Jews are invited, calling, you know, like you call somebody to invite them. The Jews are called to davening, Thanksgiving, you know, to celebrate with nice clothing and nice food, and so on and so forth. Or Rashi's Mikroi Kedush means that a person has to have good food and so on and so forth. But it has to be in a way that God's name is sanctified. It's not just a holiday to, pardon the expression, fress and eat. And even though the Torah says, "Samachta b'chagecha." So therefore, the Jews basically on Yom Tov leaves the mundane world and they sanctify it as Kodesh. It has to be treated holy. Then the Torah says like this, Sheshes Yomim, Te'asa melacha, on 6 days, work should be done. Okay, in the English, it's also, sometimes English just doesn't do justice. Te'asa melacha means 6 days, work may be done. Yeah? Uvayim ashvi, I'll explain this thing in a second. Shabbos, Shabbos, and Mikra Kedish, on the seventh day is Shabbos. Kol melacha leisasu, all melacha is not allowed to be done. Shabbos, Hil Hashem, it's a Shabbos for Hashem. B'chomesh v'seichem, in all your dwelling places. Now, what does it mean here, Shabbos, Shabbos? Yom Shabbos is not really a chag. It's not Mikra Kedish, it's not a Yom Tif. But Rashi says like this, because right away the next pasuk again says, "Ela me'adei Hashem." These are the Yom Tovim of Hashem. It's like, how does Shabbos get in the middle? So Rashi learns like this: "Mayin Shabbos etzel me'adeis." Like, what's the connection between Shabbos and Yom Tov? To teach us, whoever desecrates the Yom Tov is like desecrating Shabbos. V'chol ha'mekaymes me'adeis, whoever keeps Yom Tov, I'll consider it as if they kept the Shabbos. So there's the Torah, even though Shabbos is stricter, many people are stricter about Shabbos than Yom Tov, the Pasuk says, I'm putting Shabbos in the middle of the Yom Tovs to tell you, keep Yom Tov, I'll consider it as if you keep Shabbos. That's the way he learns. Now, there's a very interesting Kliyokot over here that explains this a little bit differently. And he says like this, why is Shabbos in between the Yom Tovs? So I have to preface this with the halacha that he discusses. When witnesses saw the moon, the din was they were allowed to travel on Shabbos. They're allowed to desecrate Shabbos to come and testify that they saw the moon. So what happens? Friday night, you know, beginning of the month, Friday night, some witnesses saw the moon. And Shabbos, they're allowed to get into the horse and wagon, or car, or make a phone call, email, picture, you know, you're allowed to desecrate Shabbos. Once Beis Din proclaimed it Rosh Chodesh, and Beis Din would send out messengers, they were not allowed to desecrate Shabbos. So it's very interesting, the halacha. To come to Beis Din to make the Rosh Chodesh, that you're allowed to do. To publicize it, that you cannot desecrate Shabbos.
So, how can you desecrate Shabbos from the beginning?
Because the Torah said so.
Where?
Right here.
Well, if we didn't learn it today, I wouldn't have known it. Nobody knows that you could desecrate Shabbat to announce something.
Not today.
In the time.
Not to announce. You're allowed, the witnesses are allowed to desecrate Shabbos to travel.
To announce that.
To come to Beis Din to testify that they saw the moon.
Uh-huh.
But once Beis Din accepted the testimony and said it's Rosh Chodesh, why is Rosh Hashanah 2 days in Israel?
Because of
what?
The moon, no?
What moon?
I have no clue.
It's a good thing you came here. You wouldn't know it either.
Because the witnesses would not...
No.
They have to... The time to announce... Time to announce...
Forget it. Let's go back.
Okay.
Back in history. How did the Jews know when Beis Din made Rosh Chodesh? They didn't send out emails.
Does that... someone had to go and announce...
No, that's not what they did. First they did that. The Gemara says, Barishaina, the mission of Rosh Hashanah. Initially, they would go up to certain mountains and light big torches. The Jews were looking out because they knew it had to be soon. The Jewish people on the next mountaintop saw that torch, so they lit big torches. The next mountain, so in a short period of time, the whole Eretz Yisrael with these torches would know that Beis Din proclaimed Rosh Chodesh. It worked. But then you have Jewish or Goyish gangsters, pranksters, so they would light fires on the mountains on the wrong day. Okay? So the whole system got messed up. So what did Beis Din do? Beis Din sent out messengers to the major Jewish cities where Jews traveled. The shluchim of Beis Din went out and they told the people that on Wednesday, Beis Din made Rosh Chodesh. So Wednesday is Aleph, and therefore you needed to know for Yom Kippur, they needed to know for Sukkot, they needed to know for Pesach. Okay, they needed to know. So in certain months, the Gemara says 6 months only, Shluchim would go out, because a certain din didn't apply, not only the Yom Tov, Shluchim would go out to tell everybody. Those Shluchim were only able to reach, by the 15th, which is Pesach and Sukkot, all over Eretz Yisrael. Places outside of Eretz Yisrael, which had less traffic and was further away, the shluchim did not get there on time. Okay? Now, the shchedesh can be either one day or the next day. Right? Because the truth of the matter is, a lunar month is approximately 29 and a half days. You can't make Rosh Chodesh in the middle of a day. I mean, it doesn't make sense. Half a day is Rosh Chodesh, half a day not. I mean, you know, you could do laundry in the morning, not in the afternoon. It doesn't make sense. So, in our calendar, it's set up. 1 month has 30 days. 1 month has 29 days. 1 month has 30 days. 1 month has 29, with the exception of Kislev and Cheshvan, because it's not exactly 29 and a half days. So therefore, sometimes it has 29 days, sometimes 2 days of Rosh Chodesh, sometimes 1 day of Rosh Chodesh. But those only 2 months, Cheshvan and Kislev, are the only 2 months that fluctuate 29 and 30. All the other months, one is Mole, one is Chaser. One is Mole, one is Chaser. Okay? That works in our calendar system. But Rosh Chodesh could be one of 2 days. If witnesses came on the 18th of the month and they said, we saw the moon, I mean, Beis Din know they're crazy. It's not Rosh Chodesh. It's one of 2 days that could be Rosh Chodesh. Okay? So, the Jews knew that either Tuesday or Wednesday could be Rosh Chodesh. So if you lived in Eretz Yisrael, the messengers got to you in time, and you knew that Wednesday was Rosh Chodesh. People that lived in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel, the Shluchim didn't get there on time, so the Jews didn't know. Do we keep Tuesday as the first day of the month, or Wednesday the first day of the month? Right? So therefore, when's Pesach, it could be 1 day or the next day. They didn't know. Therefore, outside of Eretz Yisrael, they kept 2 days. That's where Yom Tov Sheni Shegolias originated from. So it says, even though we have calendars today and we know exactly what's what, nevertheless, Minig Aviseinu Biadeinu, tradition, as Fiddler, tradition, we keep tradition. Therefore, we keep 2 days. 1 second. 1 second. We keep 2 days except in Israel. In Israel, they keep 1 day. Unless you're talking about a lot, which is a shaila, if it's biblical Eretz Yisrael or not, whatever. The problem with this is Rosh Hashanah. Oh. When the witnesses came, Rosh Hashanah in the morning, Beis Din, we saw the moon last night. And Beis Din says, okay, Mekudesh, today is Rosh Hashanah. Yeah? The horses couldn't go out on Yom Tov. You're not allowed to ride a horse. We said, once Beis Din said Mekudesh for the notification, you cannot desecrate Shabbos. So now, people that lived in Bnei Brak, may they be blessed. Yeah? How did they know? In Yerushalayim, maybe people were able to get around, talk. But people that lived outside in a different city in Shalai, and outside of in Eretz Yisrael, they also didn't know when Beis Din did it. So they also keep 2 days. Then the Gemara says even more. Even in the Beis HaMikdash, sometimes they kept 2 days. Even where the court was, they also sometimes kept 2 days. Why? So the Gemara tells a story that there was one time Beis Din was waiting in the morning. You have to understand, if it's Yom Tov, besides desecration of Yom Tov, all the Karbanos are different. The Beis Hamikdash brought different Karbanos on Yom Tov than they brought daily. Okay? So Rosh Hashanah in the morning, the Beis Din's up bright and early, waiting for witnesses to come. Usually they came in the morning. So if they came in the morning, Beis Din says, okay guys, today's Yom Tov, Karbanos, everything Yom Tov. The Gemara says, one time, the witnesses came very late. They came pushing very late. It was already late in the afternoon, and they weren't there yet. So Beis Din said, okay guys, they're not coming. Chol. It's not Rosh Hashanah. Tomorrow will be Rosh Hashanah, not today. After they did that, the witnesses showed up. So now it's a problem. If Beis Din accepts them, that means the day was Kodesh. But they did all the Chol Avoda. They did everything Chol. They didn't do anything Kodesh, because Beis Din said it's a weekday, because the witnesses didn't come. So that Beis Din, that year, made a takana, that if witnesses come after Mincha time, that day will remain holy as the rest of the day, but the real Yom Tov is the next day. How could they do it when today was the real Yom Tov? We just learned that Beis Din could do whatever they want. Beis Din could say, tomorrow is Rosh Chodesh, Rosh Hashanah, not today. So Beis Din themselves, even in the Beis HaMikdash, sometimes they kept the rest of the day holy, but the Yom Tov was the next day.
So how do they prepare cooking and all that?
In the Beis HaMikdash, Yom Tov, you're allowed to cook the Korbanos. You're allowed to do whatever needs to be done.
What about the people in Yerushalayim?
Huh?
What about the people in Yerushalayim?
So Taka, they didn't know. Until, normally the witnesses came early in the morning.
Yeah.
So then... So Beis Din said, you know what? Tomorrow's Rosh Hashanah, not today.
Okay.
But they kept the rest of the day
as holy.
Mm-hmm. But the official, so even the Beis HaMikdash kept 2 days. Coming back to this point, that's why even today in Israel they keep 2 days Rosh Hashanah.
Mm-hmm.
Because even in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, Eretz Yisrael, with the exception of the immediate Beis HaMikdash close by Yerushalayim area, they also didn't know what Shchedish was. How are they supposed to know? If they had emails, it wouldn't be a problem. Send an email and everybody knows.
But I thought they were phenomenal astronomers at the time.
They were what?
Astronomers.
So what? Beis Din...
So they knew everything.
Beis Din figured out, according to astronomy...
Calculation.
The calculation, if it's possible to see the moon or not. And then if Beis Din figured out that according to the calculations, the moon cannot be seen, and witnesses came and said they saw the moon, Beis Din knew right away they were liars.
Mm.
What?
Couldn't you just go outside and see the moon?
But...
You have to spread it all
over
Israel.
Yeah, Yerushalayim. I mean, that was...
And what happens if Yerushalayim was cloudy?
Okay.
It happens, by the way. Yeah?
Can't see anything sometimes.
They didn't have helicopters to go on top of the clouds or planes and check it out. What happened? It's possible. Yeah, of course, if Beis Din saw it, the whole Yerushalayim saw it, there wasn't a question. But what happens if it was cloudy in Yerushalayim?
I get
you. But
the Beis Din
said one day.
It says in Sfarim, by the way, how did the Jews in the Midbar, they had the clouds. Yeah? So how did they do Kiddush Levana in the Midbar?
Mm-hmm.
So it's brought down in Sfarim, the Moshe Rabbeinu took a handkerchief, went like this, the clouds opened, the Jews saw the moon, did Kiddush Levana, and then they closed back.
Mm-hmm.